dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman who has brought some significant intelligence to bear in the Fourth Estate, as it's called, I'm very pleased to say, is our first guest. Her name is Sophie Mann. She is these days a reporter for Just the News, John Solomon's terrific news organization, which partnered up with the Real America's Voice Network, on which I'm very pleased to say our Securing America television program is featured. Sophie is also a former Bartley Fellow at the Wall Street Journal, Bob Bartley being its longtime editor and a great reporter as well as editor, and a man I admired and was privileged to call a friend. So for all these reasons, it's a pleasure to be able to welcome her to our microphones for the first time. Sophie, thanks so much for joining us. You wrote a piece last week, Sophie, on a subject that I don't think has gotten nearly as much attention as it should, that being the refusal of not only the Russians and Chinese, quite predictably, but even our European allies to continuing the arms embargo on the sale to or sale other transfer by the Iranian regime. It's hard to imagine a more addled and dangerous proposition than that we should see those guys have access to the world's arms markets again. Talk a little bit about what went on behind the scenes in that regard, and then we'll talk about one of its upshots that's also quite ominous.
Yeah, sure. Well, so several weeks ago, I think coming up on 2 weeks now, the UN Security Council resolution that barred Iran from shipping to other countries, importing or exporting sort of massive weapons of war expired. The U.S. had pushed very hard behind the scenes to renew the embargo, but, you know, as we know, is no longer a member of the UN Security Council, and so was not able to wrangle, as you said, our allies to approve that vote, despite some objection from Iran's own neighbors in the region. You know, six Arab Gulf state countries said that they would support, along with the United States, seeing the embargo renewed, as they fear a nuclear or even just more militarily powerful Iran, the way that many parts of the Western world do as well. But, you know, the bottom line is that this should never have happened and is the result of a Security Council that continually displays weak judgment when it comes to Iran. Iran is a country that, you know, has broken the rules of the now defunct Obama era nuclear accord from day one and has continued to violate international agreements pertaining to the development of its nuclear arsenal. And this is, you know, just another strategic move on their part. We'll see sort of what they end up doing with this new freedom. For now, they are telling us that and the world that they have no imminent plans to go on a buying spree, but you know, paying lip service to what will comfort its neighbors is hardly a good faith promise from the regime.
Especially a regime that is so completely untrustworthy on anything it says, right? Of particular concern, Sophie Mann, is the fact that whether they buy new weapons or not, they seem to feel they're no longer constrained in selling or transferring, at least, arms to others. And I think they've been doing this quite a bit, even in the face of this embargo, when they could get away with it. But they haven't always gotten away with it. And more to the point, if they now feel that they are legally entitled to do it, it seems as though it's likely there will be more of that kind of thing happening. President Trump's administration has served notice, I believe in the person of Elliot Abrams, who was a special envoy on Venezuela, that if the Iranian regime does actually act on something that has been discussed, as we understand it, between the Iranians and the Venezuelans in the past, namely the transfer of reasonably long-range missiles from Iran to Venezuela, where they would be based and perhaps within range of the United States, that the United States government would intercept them or otherwise act to neutralize such weapons, which could, you know, be quite a strategic development, to say the least. What do we know about that beyond what I've just described? And do you think this is a credible prospect based on what the Iranians have done to date and the circumstances in which they now find themselves?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, an incredibly credible prospect. We know just in these past several months, Iran has shipped massive shipments of oil to Venezuela. They have a suspiciously close relationship. As Special Envoy Abrams said, this would not be acceptable in any degree to the United States and to the Trump administration. We've seen Iran ship missiles, you know, all over its own region, destabilizing and destroying several nations along the way. I think the theory here is that, you know, any delivery of Iranian arms, and as you said, relatively long-range missiles to South America and the Caribbean, destabilizes the region, not just in terms of it, of those missiles being able to reach, you know, America, but in terms of them being able to reach Brazil and Colombia and Guyana and just the entire South American region that, that, you know, they don't want Iran's footprint there any more than the United States does. So it seems to be the case that the Trump administration is keeping a very watchful eye on the potential for that sort of shipment to begin arriving. Again, Iran says that they have no plans to do that. I suppose it is possible that these warnings from the Trump administration will effectively act as a deterrent. But again, this is just not a regime we can trust to do that. We've seen them, as I said, in these past several months, deliver shipments to Venezuela. There's clearly a close working relationship between those governments. And so I think it's, as you said, a very credible threat and real possibility that those missiles could be arriving in this hemisphere sooner than we would hope.
You mentioned that the U.S. government has, in fact, engaged in the past with some of these shipments, specifically oil shipments. So there's clearly a precedent. Now, in that case, the ships were not sunk or the missiles or whatever. The fuel in that case, I guess, was the cargo, was not destroyed, but it didn't reach its intended target, that's for sure. And it seems as though that's a good precedent and a good model. One other piece of this that adds to the urgency of it, it seems to me, is I had an interview recently with Joseph Heumeier of the Center for a Secure Free Society, one of our specialists on Latin America and specifically on foreign intervention in Latin America. And he warned in a paper at the Atlantic Council recently that Hezbollah, which, as you know, of course, Sophie, is the Iranian sort of foreign legion, is all over Venezuela these days, as is, I think, the Iranian government itself. So much to be closely following. I'm very pleased you're on the case at Just the News, and I hope you'll come back to us with updates very soon. Thank you for joining us today. Good to talk with you. Next up, we'll speak with George Raceley of Conservative Headquarters about the election and what is in prospect now with respect to it. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and it is always a distinct privilege to say, and pleasure, that we are joined by our duty genius. He is George Raceley, a member of the Mensa Society. He is a very experienced political hand, having served in some 300 campaigns, including all of the presidential ones until about 2008, I believe. And he has been very much a prolific and thoughtful contributor to the public policy debate, notably in his post as editor of Richard Viguerie's Conservative HQ newsletter. It's great to have you with us, George. Thank you for coming aboard to talk at this momentous time. Well, I particularly want to sort of ask you to do some crystal ball gazing, because you have gone out on a limb in one of your recent pieces that I believe was published by the Tennessee Star, entitled Three Big Reasons Trump Will Be Reelected. And this is just a fact-finding conversation, of course, but tell us what those reasons are as you see them.
Well, there are a bunch of reasons why I think Trump will be reelected. Some of them are, you know, sort of technical political reasons of how he's running a better campaign than Biden and Harris. But I think the number one of the three would be the, for lack of a better term, we'll say the way that Democrats have branded themselves as opponents of American exceptionalism and as haters of the country they aspire to govern. And in, you know, over 40 years of politics, you know, calling the people that are going to elect you racists and you know, deplorables and chumps is not a good way to get votes.
No, I understand. It's a very challenging but professional liability, needless to say. But you quote in this piece something that I hadn't seen before, and you would have thought that opposition research would have made it prominent in this campaign, that in 2014, Joe Biden actually told a class at Harvard University, quote, "There's nothing special about being an American," unquote. That does sound like a bit of that, you know, hate America syndrome that is generally regarded as toxic. I remember the famous quip of Jean Kirkpatrick back in the day when she described the Democrats as the party of blame America first. Is that what's likely to alienate voters, perhaps even some Democrats, but certainly independents and Republicans, to the point where you think that this gives President Trump a decisive edge, especially since he takes very much a contrary view?
Yeah, well, the but there's more to it than just Joe Biden. I mean, it's a general part of the Democrat brand, and so and there's a lot of polling that supports this view that it is a as you put it, toxic, but it's more generally alienates a broad spectrum of Americans. I mean, there's a good Hill Harris poll that found that 47% of Americans believe that speaking out against the U.S. is unpatriotic. And so when you're already alienating 47% of the electorate, you've got a big problem. And, you know, it's Joe Biden, it's Andrew Cuomo saying America was never great, it's AOC saying that America is garbage, and so on and so on and so on. So it's become an essential part of the Democrat brand.
Well, unfortunately, I think it's in part that because they, among others, their fellow travelers, if you will, have successfully indoctrinated an awful lot of Americans to feel that that's the case. You know, this phenomenon of finding, as I'm told, the largest single professional occupation of those who have been arrested in connection with these riots across the country are public school teachers. And, you know, it tells you a lot about what's been passed on to our children and in successive generations. So the question, I guess, George, and I want to move on to another topic with you, but if Donald Trump actually has successfully branded his opponents, and they have to some extent branded themselves as hostile to the United States or certainly deprecating towards it, that is a winning position for, you know, an American presidential candidate is actually encouraging to me, because we do see so much evidence that Americans simply don't have that loving feeling towards their own country anymore. And I trust you're right that that's not the case. We certainly feel that we love this country, but it is stunning how many seem not to. George, let me turn to, if I can, evidence that Hunter Biden doesn't seem to have much use for it, that's for sure, and has been willing to sell it out, it seems, to, among others, communist China. What do you make, first of all, of what we've learned about him and his activities through the revelations of this laptop, and more generally, about his family, including the so-called big guy?
Well, you know, having done some policy advocacy during my career, I'm quite sure that I would be in the big house, not hanging out with the big guy, if I did half of what Hunter and Jim Biden have revealed to have done. But I think that maybe the bigger story is how adept the Chinese have been, the Red Chinese, in penetrating the highest levels of American politics. And what these revelations do is prove what a lot of us have seen, sort of the Indian smoke signals, if you will, of this going on. And it makes me wonder how many other senators and members of Congress and other high level, you know, in our political elite have been similarly penetrated.
This is a topic that is very much on my mind for several reasons. Notably, we are featuring in my commentary today a remarkable speech by the Deputy National Security Advisor to the President, Matthew Pottinger, that he gave to Policy Exchange, a British think tank, as you probably know, George, last week, I guess, in Mandarin, no less, because he really wanted to speak to the Chinese people over the heads of their elites. But it's basically about what the Chinese have been doing with their United Front Work Department operations to do just what you're talking about, which is to influence and recruit and otherwise suborn Americans of various stripes, elites most especially, the media, Hollywood, government individuals, the journalists, and most especially, I think, the financial sector, which has enabled them to underwrite a tremendous amount of the harmful things that they've been doing. So, George, just a quick question. Last night, Tucker Carlson hosted a man who has come forth to confirm important parts of what's now been disclosed from Hunter Biden's laptop. What was your takeaway from former Navy Lieutenant Tony Babalinsky's exchanges with Tucker Carlson?
Well, my family entered the news media business in 1835, and that was the most astonishing piece of media that I've seen, and I got my first media byline in 1976, ever. It was a Moab on top of Biden, yep, on top of Biden headquarters. But if a Moab drops on the Biden headquarters and no one reports it, did it blow up Biden's campaign? And so what we see this morning is all the establishment media is ignoring it. I mean, you know, Good Morning America, not a squeak. The same with the other, you know, old dinosaur networks. It was as if it didn't happen. And so it's going to be up to Fox and conservatives on social media, and hopefully, you know, Rush and other talk radio hosts to get the details of it out, which are essentially that not only did the Bidens do business with Red China willingly and, you know, with great enthusiasm, but they looted every business that they were involved in. there was no actual business being conducted. It was merely a vehicle to transfer cash to Hunter Biden, Jim Biden, and presumably based on, you know, the texts and emails to Joe Biden himself.
George, we have to leave it at that. There's so much more to talk to you about. We will probably do so after the election, and we will be very keen to see if your predictions are fulfilled. Stay tuned, my friends. We will talk about that and more with Diana West right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. And it's always a pleasure to say a warm welcome to our regular featured guest in this time frame. Her name is Diana West. She is a syndicated columnist of many years, a very, very important author of three books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and The Red Thread, A Search for Ideological Drivers in the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. You can find her writing and thoughts at dianawest.net as well. Diana, it's good to have you back. Welcome. Well, I always look forward to these conversations, Diana, because you provide sort of a prism on what is going on in our time that doesn't always make sense or necessarily have clarity for the rest of us. And I wanted to ask you about what you made of just one example of the very disparate treatment that the two presidential contenders have been receiving from the mainstream media in particular, and what the impact of that is likely to be on the electorate. And let me just give you a prime example of the treatment of Donald Trump. The interview that he had with 60 Minutes, conducted by Leslie Stahl, we saw the unexpurgated version from the White House preemptively, and then we saw what 60 Minutes actually packaged up. How would you describe, basically, that as it seems to exemplify the rather, shall we say, aggressively hostile attitude of the media towards this president?
Well, I think in so many ways we need to rethink what the media is. The media, the news media, as we call them, the press, as we used to call them, they are participants in the election process in a way that I don't think we've even seen them before, which is, you know, again, we're always talking about degree here because these trends have been present in our society for so long. But in terms of even the pretense of being a fact-finding profession, journalism is gone. And, you know, at this point, fact-finding and non-neutral would be all right. It's just I'd settle for less here. But basically, the facts, they are a fact-hiding operation to pursue a political agenda. And I think that it's not that we haven't seen this throughout election cycles. I'm thinking back to even the 1990s when we saw the Bill Clinton stories breaking in the Washington Times. I was there at the time, that the mainstream media would not cover regarding his anti-Americanism, his draft dodging, the womanizing. I mean, a lot of this stuff, I'm thinking of the name Jerry Sieper back in the old days, a lot of this stuff was breaking and the mainstream media would not cover it before the election. So we can see this pattern certainly repeated over the decades, but now we actually have, you know, these advocates in the face of the president saying black is white. And you know, you bring up Leslie Stahl, and I would just say where she said there's no evidence that the Obama administration spied on the Trump campaign. That's what she said, that she was scoffing, dismissive of the president. He did not allow her to get away with it, of course. And as well he should not, because there is hundreds of pages of evidence from the Inspector General report in just one place to look that actually prove this was going on. And she, as a journalist, was telling the President of the United States and America, for example, in this one example, that there was no evidence.
You know, what was really striking about it, it was freighted as well with this rather contemptuous posture that we're 60 Minutes, and if we can't verify something, we won't air it. Indeed, this evidence is all about them, but they still won't air it, evidently. Let me just pivot then, Dinah, to another sort of example of how this is working. The press has, of course, the media, if you will, has, of course, been largely deep-sixing the evidence that has burst forth, nonetheless, in the past week or so, involving this laptop computer, the president calls it the laptop from hell, from Hunter Biden, with its copious quantities of evidence, further evidence, that not only Hunter and other Biden family members, but apparently the presidential candidate himself, have been corruptly dealing with hostile powers, including both Russia and China, in ways that certainly seem to compromise this prospective commander-in-chief. A very, very serious national security issue, it seems to me. And yet it's gotten scarcely any attention. And the fellow who has come forth to confirm much of this, a former Navy lieutenant by the name of Anthony Babalinsky, has been largely, you know, banished from the media's scrutiny as well, except for the purpose, of course, of character assassination. Talk through, you know, how this treatment speaks to this larger problem, and then we'll talk about what it might mean for the election next week.
Well, again, a staggering example, because here you have things written down, you have documentary evidence of a close eyewitness participant in the Biden family malfeasance here. I mean, this is a national security scandal of the highest order when the prospective commander in chief has been trading on his prospective presidential office in a family business, which is exactly what these emails and text messages and this testimony of Tony Babalinsky and others at this point who have come forward suggests in the most strongest evidentiary way. The media is treating it as something that they can just keep to the fringe. And I just will read you the headline today from Politico. After Babalinsky went a full Tucker Carlson show to discuss these things. So we have the man himself in front of us, as well as his evidence. Their headline today is MAGA Scrambles to Repair the Hunter Biden Narrative. I mean, I don't even understand what the title means. That's the headline. And it goes on to attack Rudy Giuliani for pushing the story, other aspects of the story, you know, and then toward the middle or end, you get onto this notion that this man, Babalinsky, who is certainly a face on this story, someone with a long career, also a military career, also a Q clearance in his earlier life, which is a very high-level clearance, they dismiss him as this person who appeared on Tucker Carlson with this story, and it's one of those things where it's how did you like the play Mrs. Lincoln after the assassination of President Lincoln? I mean, it's that kind of reversal of the importance of an evidence, which is not their role. Their role is not to prioritize stories as to which will elect their candidate. They are supposed to present evidence, and as they discuss it, as it's revealed, that is journalism. It's a rolling wagon train through events, and it's often wrong, and it gets corrected, and it's supposed to put it all out there for the American people to assess and understand and discount or be affected by. They have abdicated that role to a point where you can't call them news media anymore. They are, you know, DNC propaganda machine, and it's partisans beyond partisans.
I haven't seen this particular article, but I take it that the headline was what you were supposed to read and not be bothered by what follows after. And from all accounts, I think what came across last night in the Tucker Carlson interview with Tony Bobulinski is not something that destroyed the so-called MAGA, Make America Great Again narrative, but to the contrary, add further texture to its validity and its compelling character. And it's something the American people obviously need to know about. Dana, let me just quickly ask about one other thing. I had a chance to see over the weekend a movie called The Social Dilemma. I don't know if you've seen it or not. It's a documentary. It's about basically the other part of the media at the moment, namely the social media, and what role it is playing in all of this. The point of it being that a number of industry insiders, including some who are quite prominent in the sort of tech giant space, describe how the algorithms have really been designed to feed you information that ostensibly you would like, but I think more to the point that the internet platforms think will help them manipulate you. And whether it's for the purposes of buying products from their advertisers or whether it's perhaps buying the presidential candidate they favor. And like the so-called mainstream press, it's pretty clear that that's, you know, the Democratic candidate and his ticket. These are things that are very troubling because they clearly speak to this question of, will we have an informed electorate making what may well be the most important decision of their lives, namely, who will be our next commander-in-chief? Who will be a person charged with protecting us and leading our country and not, one would hope, fundamentally transforming it into a socialist state or a state that is submissive to a hostile power like the Chinese Communist Party. These are the things that we'll be watching closely. Dinah West, we are hard out of time. We appreciate so much yours and the insights you provide into, as I say, the culture, the society, our politics, and the decisions that flow from all of the above. Keep up the great work, my dear, at dinahwest.net. Come back to us again next week. We'll have a lot to talk about, I think. Next up, we'll speak with Se-Hun Kim. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and I'm very pleased to say welcome for the first time to these microphones for a man who I've come to regard very highly for both his vision and his leadership abilities in connection with a project that has come to be called the Captive Nations Coalition. And it's an initiative of our Committee on the Present Danger, China. This initiative would not have gotten off the ground, really, were it not for the considerable efforts as well as the talents of Se-Hun Kim, who is the director of the CNC, as we call it, acronyms being a favorite preoccupation here in Washington. And it's a delight to have a chance to talk to Se-Hun in the aftermath of a terrific webinar that he put together that we ran last night. And if you'd like to see it, and I hope you will, particularly after you hear more about it, you can go to presentdangerchina.org and view the two-hour program that we put together for yourself. Se-Hun Kim, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. So tell us a little bit about this concept of captive nations. I'm of an age where I remember that term being used to describe nations that had been, well, enslaved by the Soviet Union back in the day. Is that basically what's meant by it today as well with respect to China?
Yes, absolutely. But I would go as far as to say, to take that a little beyond what you've very well described here, that this is also an opportunity for all of the folks, whether it be Southern Mongolians, the Tibetans, the people of East Turkestan, and to all peoples of China, it's an opportunity for them to have a relief of fresh air, meaning that for the first time in decades, especially ever since the West has began to do business with China, and many of the human rights atrocities were ignored, through this coalition, this is an opportunity for them to actually tell their stories and actually share their experiences for the rest of us to really realize what type of things were done during this so-called economic prosperity that's been happening for the past decades. And it gives us an outlook of what freedom truly is. And I think that's probably the most important thing that could ever have happened so far. And in principle, it's probably the best thing that ever have occurred in terms of the reminder of the value of our freedom and the democracy that we all have, firstly here, and the reasons and the great principle behind what they're fighting for as well. So, yeah.
So this is partly focused on countries that are currently subject to the terrible oppression and misrule of the Chinese Communist Party. You mentioned Southern Mongolia, Tibet, the Uyghurs of East Turkestan. I guess Manchuria fits into that mix as well. But it's also about this larger universe of nations that have been targeted by the Chinese Communist Party for what can only, I think, be described as, domination and exploitation, pursuant to something called the Belt and Road Initiative. Talk a little bit about how those nations fit into your larger captive nations coalition, Sehun Kim.
So that's an excellent point, Frank. As it did happen to Southern Mongolia, East Turkestan, and Tibet, the Chinese Communist Party is also trying to offer the similar benefits and promises of friendship and et cetera, as they did to all of these nations, to what we know as sovereign nations of the world today. The job of the Captive Nations Coalition is to highlight some of those threats that we see are repeating in our current society, particularly, as you've mentioned, through the Belt and Road Initiative, which many have described as a neocolonialism effort for the CCP to essentially assert its dominance and influence all over the world. So in retrospect, the Captive Nations Coalition isn't just focused on those countries and of those people that are under the occupation of the Chinese Communist Party, but for all the other nations that are under severe pressure of the Chinese Communist Party or pretty much under the economic control of China at this point. And I think that itself is significant because through soft power and through economic might of the CCP itself, we see countries after countries falling and eventually giving up their sovereignty. And like what has happened to Sri Lanka or even to many parts of Africa, the nations over there, they're having to give up their national assets in order to pay back these loans that the Chinese Communist Party has given them years ago as a promise of sharing in benefits and prosperity within this whole economic scope of relations that was being forged.
I've actually had a colleague from Nigeria say that it was explicitly in Mandarin, not in the English version, I guess, but in the Mandarin text of the Belt and Road Initiative that his country, Nigeria, accepted, that in the event they defaulted, their sovereignty would be forfeit, which is really stunning. And I think this is what's been happening in practice, but it was actually spelled out, albeit not in the language that the native people of Nigeria were conversant in.
Right, and that's the whole nature of the beast that we're dealing with. I mean, you have to remember, the Chinese Communist Party does not play fairly. They do not like the terms of other countries. Either it's on their terms or it's no terms at all. And if it involves any unfair practices that we view as something that would eventually would mean harm to other countries, but mean benefits to the Chinese Communist Party itself. I mean, that's the type of the attitude and the way of practices that they will embrace at all times.
So how did you find these points most powerfully made in this webinar yesterday, Sehun Kim? You were, you know, one of the moderators, as was I, for the program, but it had so many high points. Is there one or two that you could, you know, sort of call to our audience's attention in the hopes that they'll view the entirety of it at presentdangerchina.org?
Well, every single one of them, I think, made a universal point. And I think your audience needs to really keep this in mind, is that every single one of them, whether they're from a country like Kazakhstan or some of the Balkan nations or from nations that are currently under captivity by the CCP, their point was that they have no rights. Their rights were either taken away, their freedoms are taken away, and they're now subjected almost now to a complete communist authoritarianism. And that it needs to be stopped right now, or that it will eventually dominate the whole world. That was pretty much the most powerful message that anyone, I believe, could take away from the webinar itself, is that this threat is real and it has happened. And all of these nations that are suffering right now, are an undeniable testament to all of them. And it's a reminder for all of us to really pay attention to their plight, rather than just go on with our lives, ignoring all of these facts that are right under our noses.
Willful blindness will not spare us the consequences of allowing this to run its full course, which ultimately, let's be clear, is world domination. Don't take my word for it, or Sehun Kim's. That's what Xi Jinping makes clear is his China dream. Sehun, we're out of time, I'm afraid, before we're out of things to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us with further updates on the progress of the Captive Nations Coalition, an extremely important priority, not least because of what these people are telling us about the importance of America as well as a bulwark on behalf of freedom and the people who aspire to it or enjoy it today. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.